and generally we get inspected. And that spectrum can have sharp lines, and it can have broad lines, and it can have continuum. And since the topic is dynamics, I'm going to be talking mostly about these broad lines that appear in our spectra, and what is the reason why something is neither sharp nor continuum. We have a picture of some kind of a zero order state which is able to couple to something which is continuous. And what is the mechanism of that coupling? Well, there's two kinds of photofragmentation processes. We add a photon to our molecule and it can break, and that's photodissociation. Or we can add a photon to our molecule and it can ionize, and that's autoionization or ionization, photoionization. And because the final state in both of these processes is continuous in energy, we can have any translational energy, relative translational energy of these guys, or any translational energy of the electron relative to the ion. So one might expect that the spectrum will be energy increasing. The spectrum will consist of some lines and then some kind of continuum that starts up at the thermodynamic threshold for either dissociation or ionization. And we know, in fact, we're really interested in the thermodynamic threshold for both of these processes, because that gives us the bond energy and the ionization potential and stuff like that. But the continuum doesn't start at threshold, and it has a lot of structure. And that structure is connected with the internal states of A and B, or the internal states of this ion. This ion has rotation, vibration, spin orbit, electronic structure. And so somehow the internal states of these things are manifest in the structure continuum, the resonances that appear in the photofragmentation spectrum. And so we're really interested in the quasi-bound states, which are somehow connected with the internal states of these things. And another name for a quasi-bound state is a resonance. Okay, so we're going to be studying what gives rise to the widths of these resonances, which is the coupling between the bound state and the underlying continuum of lower resonance. And in particular, we're going to talk about autoionization, because last time we talked a lot about vibrational overlap integrals, and that's what's relevant to predissociation. And I could have talked at much greater length about that, but I think it's much more fun to talk about autoionization. Now, autoionization is all about an electron weakly bound to an ion. And somehow, energy gets from the ion into this electron. And that's a difficult thing to imagine, because if you imagine a collision between a light particle and a heavy particle. No energy, no significant energy is added to or removed from the heavy particle unless there's some very special thing if the light particle somehow gets embedded in the heavy particle. Or heavy particle is really sticky, or heavy particle is whatever. Right? So that's what we're going to talk about. What are the possible mechanisms for exchange of energy between an electron and a molecular ion? And we're going to try not just to talk about it phenomenologically, but we're going to actually try to bring out what are the specific interactions that enable this kind of process to occur, this energy transfer process to occur, despite the kinematic difficulties. Okay, now I gave you 21 pages from the book. Some of you have a handout consisting of roughly half of those pages, and I don't quite know why I chose to give you those. So this is the complete section you want to see. Okay, in order to talk about these things, I have to introduce Rydberg states. And I'm going to do it in as superficial a way as I can get away with, because that's a topic that would take many lectures if I did it honestly. Okay, so let's start out. We have a hydrogen atom. Our picture of Rydberg states is based on the picture of the hydrogen atom. And for the hydrogen atom, the energy levels, and I'm always going to use spectroscopic units, so at least for now I'm going to divide by HC explicitly, but you won't catch me doing that in real life. So the energy is equal to the ionization potential minus the Rydberg over n squared. The Rydberg is equal to the ionization potential, is equal to 109,737 recipital centimeters. Just one of those numbers that I have had to look up so many times that I finally remembered it. I don't have any more digits, but there are more. So, and n is an integer, 1, 2, 3. And so these are the energy levels of hydrogen. And in addition, the energy levels of hydrogen do not depend on the orbital angular momentum. Hydrogen is an electron bound to a point nucleus. It's like, it's a little bit like the inert gas approximation, the ideal gas approximation, right? We have non-interacting particles. That point nucleus has a very nice property that it, no matter how the electron looks at it, from far or from close in, it has a charge of exactly one and it's round. So, the next step in complexity is the sodium atom. And the sodium atom has energy levels which are specified by three quantum numbers. And again, we have an ionization potential, and we have a formula, n minus quantum defect, and that quantum defect has two quantum numbers, L and J. Okay, so what is this? It looks like it's just a fudge factor. It just looks like we're trying to use this formula. And in order to use it, we have to say, well, n isn't quite an integer. But there's still some regularity here. It's saying that n isn't quite an integer, but its difference from an integer is the same for all members of a Rydberg series with the same value of L and J. So we might have a P Rydberg series, that's L equals 1, and J would be 3 halves. And for all Rydberg states of this, with these quantum numbers, the quantum defect will be the same. And we could have a P. Rydberg series where J is a half, and then this quantum defect would be a little different. But again, the same for all n. Well, the Rydberg constant is the same as for hydrogen, almost. There's a slight reduced mass effect. But the ionization potential is very different. So, what we learn from sodium, which is like hydrogen except the nucleus isn't a point, is that we need to introduce these quantum defects which make the integer, the energies not given by integers, and the different L's and J's have different quantum defects. And the quantum defects, S, one half, is large, P, one half, is smaller, P, three halves is still a little smaller, but really this is, S is much larger than the P's, and then we continue, and we have delta for F, five halves, which is approximately equal to delta for F. What's the matter with this blackboard? Seven halves, which is approximately zero. So what happens is the quantum defects, still thought of as fudge factors for the moment, are large for S and smaller for P, and eventually they're so small that they're nearly zero, and we get back to a quasi-hydrogenic situation. Well, these quantum defects are not fudge factors. They are what happens to an electron which scatters off of this nucleus. When it scatters off of the nucleus has an effective charge which depends on the distance of the electron from the nucleus. Because there are electrons around it. There's an inner shell of electrons. Two inner shells. And so as the electron gets in close, it sees a larger charge, means it's pulled in. It has higher energy than the corresponding N and L for hydrogen, higher binding energy. And because the effective potential for a sodium has the form of Z of R over R minus I. That's the Coulomb potential. So this is what had been 1 for hydrogen. But this is a function that it goes from 1 at long distance up to the atomic number of sodium, which is
23.
That's mass number. Sorry. 2 plus 8 plus 1. Right? 11. Okay, and then we have a repulsion, L plus 1. That's the centrifugal barrier. Because the electron has angular momentum, it can't get in close. And so as L increases, even though the nucleus isn't a point, the electron doesn't know it.
So basically we're assuming we have one different electron and the other electrons are just a core which create an effective Z.
That's right. So, whenever we can approach a problem by making most of the particles inactive, we'll do that. And that's always wrong, but its wrongness is usually much less than other wrongnesses that we adopt in treating a system. And so, the fact of treating the ion core as passive leads to corrections that we will make, and in fact, when I talk about electronic autoionization, that is one of the things that no longer is one of the assumptions that we no longer make. The electron comes in, smacks the ion core, and excites one of the electrons. And this is kind of a neat mechanism because it says, okay, we're transferring energy, but not to the heavy object, but to an electron, another electron. So when we need to open up the core and make them not passive, we do that. Okay, good question. Okay, so because of this, at high orbital angular momentum, we get a return to hydrogenic behavior. And this leads to the distinction between core penetrating Rydberg states and core non-penetrating Rydberg states. And the way in which the two experience dynamics is different because one can get close and one can't. And we can use the two different classes of states as different kinds of probes of the structure of the ion core. Okay, the quantum defect is not a fudge factor. The quantum defect is a phase shift. If a phase shift of the wave function scattering off the core relative to what it would have been if it was hydrogen. So, since the ion core has a higher charge than hydrogen, the electron is pulled in. It accumulates some extra phase as it goes by, and so there is a phase shift. And this phase shift can also be thought of as for a particular value of the orbital angular momentum. The electron experiences a phase shift, yet it has to somehow, if it's in a bound state, go to infinity with amplitude zero at infinity. And if the phase shift is wrong, it won't do that, and that can't be a solution to the Schrödinger equation. So there has to be phase shifts because the charge isn't one. The phase shift is going to depend on the orbital angular momentum. But the thing that's a little bit unexpected is that all members of a Rydberg series will have the same phase shift, the same quantum defect, to a very good approximation. And this leads to another important aspect of Rydberg states. If we plot the wave function versus R, versus R, we have some nodes, and if we focus only on the inner part of the wave function, the shape of the inner part of the wave function, in particular the position of the antinode and the first node, doesn't move as you go along a Rydberg series. The only thing that happens is that the amplitude here is scaled as n to the minus 3 halves. And there are many ways of explaining this, but I don't have time. One way, which is the least good way, but which I can just say, you need this to make the wave functions orthogonal. But another way of saying it is that because the kinetic energy of the electron when it's near the core is so enormous, the de Broglie wavelength doesn't change much when you change the energy relative to the ionization limit, because the ionization energy is a small fraction of the energy of the electron near the core. And so it's because of that that this de Broglie wavelength, or average de Broglie wavelength, is independent of n. But this leads to all sorts of useful scaling laws for Rydberg states. So, since the only different thing between sodium and hydrogen is this quantum defect, one might suspect that all dynamics is encoded in the quantum defect, and that is correct. Now, for molecules, there are more kinds of quantum defects, and the quantum defect really isn't a constant, but it's a matrix, because sodium is round, orbital angular momentum is conserved for sodium. But molecules aren't round. And so you come in with a P wave, you can come out with a D wave. And so there has to be, the quantum defect has to be something that allows scattering. And so it would, it's not just a bunch of constants, which would be diagonal elements of a matrix, but it has off diagonal elements too. But we talk about eigen quantum defects, which are, in a sense, the eigenvalues of this matrix. And each Rydberg series has an eigen quantum defect, but it's also L-mixed. Okay, so now, so for a molecule, AV, we can have vibrational levels of the ion core. Each vibrational level has rotational levels. We can have, if this is, say, a doublet pi state, we could have a doublet pi 1/2, and then a similar manifold of states for doublet pi 3/2, and then there'll be more excited states. So the ion core has many electronic rotation vibration levels. And because the ion core has many levels, there's going to be a Rydberg series of the molecule converging to each of the levels of the ion core. Well, you might say, well, that's too bad. That means that life is going to become incredibly complicated. So you could also say, that's wonderful. There are lots of dynamical processes that we can probe. It just depends on, you know, whether you're whether you have the disposition of Ryan Tom or of me. However, there is a nice thing, and that is that many of the processes associated with these huge number of different Rydberg series are all related. And so you just find a way to use these multiplicity of interactions to determine the small number of terms that you need to have essentially a global description of everything that can happen. So I mentioned Rydberg scaling rules. That means that basically, for a family of processes, you need one coupling constant, and then it scales to describe all members of the family. And so as long as you know there are going to be scaling rules, you can go and measure the one process, that the one specific effect that samples what you need most sensitively. So, because there are a huge number of of states that are tied up, I mean, each Rydberg series has an infinite number of pump states and then a continuum associated with it. So, there's a lot of stuff and there's a lot of possibilities for accidental degeneracies. And when there's an accidental degeneracy, then any interaction matrix element between the accidentally degenerate states leads to trouble, leads to dynamics. Requires some special treatment. So we want to know what are the quantum numbers that make states immune from interaction with each other, and what are the quantum numbers which are only advisory as opposed to rigorous. So we have selection rules and propensity rules, and the rigorously good quantum numbers, of course, are the energy, the total angular momentum, the projection of the total angular momentum. But that, these go bad if there's an external field. But without an external field and parity, it would be nice if there were more, but that's it. And then there are a whole host of approximately good quantum numbers. And those are the ones that we use to label the states. And those get compromised by interactions which we would like to ignore, but can't quite. So, first of all, we want to look at the various terms in our perturbation Hamiltonian to find out what they destroy and what approximate quantum numbers they still leave us. And so here's our catch-all of all the bad stuff. And if we're interested in the electronic Hamiltonian, we have this operator. Okay, this operator destroys all one electron orbitals, or all one electron quantum numbers. But all many electron angular momenta are conserved, as far as this operator is concerned. And they are rigorously conserved. So total J, total S, if we, since it's not round, total L is not conserved. But the projection of total J, projection of L, the projection of S, those are all conserved as far as this is concerned. This is a scalar. And so that also means that all of the matrix elements of this are independent of projection quantum numbers. They depend only on orbital angular momentum and magnitude. So lots of things are conserved. Now this is a two-electron operator. And that means that we can have a selection rule. The change in the spin orbitals, this is not spin orbit coupling. This is, we write a wave function as a product of occupied spin orbitals. We specify the orbital quantum number and the spin for each orbital. And so a state is a list of occupied spin orbitals. That's like an electronic configuration. In an electronic configuration, you only specify the orbitals. So it's a little bit more information. And because it's a two-electron operator, the change in the number of spin orbitals is less than or equal to 2. So states differing by 3 spin orbitals are not going to be coupled. And now normally, we're talking about Rydberg states. And so different Rydberg orbitals are different spin orbitals. So if we had an interaction between two Rydberg states, generally we'd be changing one spin orbital automatically. And then to make up the difference, there's going to have to be some energy in the core. And so only states, excited electronic states of the ion core, involving a change of one more spin orbital, could possibly interact. So there are restrictions on which interactions we'd have to worry about at the first level of complexity. Okay, now for spin orbit. It has a rigorous selection rule, delta omega equals 0. It's a one electron operator, and so the delta spin orbitals is less than or equal to 1. Delta S is equal to 0 plus or minus 1. The spin of an electron, we know, is always equal to half. And so we're not going to change the spin of an electron, but we could change the total spin by 0 or 1, the spin orbit, but not by 2. Directly. You could do spin orbit in 2 steps to change the spin by 2, but that would be a less important process, something that one would only invoke if considering all of the normal dynamical mechanisms fail to explain the observation. So you might have to go beyond that. But we normally don't want to go. We'd like to know what we have to consider before we start just throwing the kitchen sink at a problem. Okay, and we can also say, all right, we have some Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian is an implicit function of the internuclear distance, and so we could write it as dHdr r minus re plus. In other words, we're expressing it as a power series. Okay, and so these are still matrices, but the important thing to notice is this is the coordinate displacement operator that appears in the harmonic oscillator problem. And so when you looked at integrals that are not zero for harmonic oscillators, this one has a selection rule, delta V of plus and minus 1. This one has a selection rule, delta V of plus and minus 2 and 0. And so the R dependence of the perturbation Hamiltonian, whether it's explicit or implicit, can give rise to vibrational changes. And each of these terms has an explicit R dependence, V dependence, vibrational selection. So vibration is a propensity rule. Vibrational propensity rules are here. But the change in vibration normally tells you which derivative of the Hamiltonian, the perturbation Hamiltonian, you're dealing with. Okay. All right, we have internal angular momenta of Rydberg states, and since we're going to separate the Rydberg electron from the ion core, we need to specify three kinds of angular momenta: the ion core angular momenta, the Rydberg electron angular momenta, and the total angular momenta. So, for example, we have J, the total angular momentum, is equal to J plus the total angular momentum of the ion core plus L plus S, the two angular momenta that the Rydberg electron could have. And if we don't like J, because we only need J when spin orbit is important. When spin orbit is not important, we can simplify our lives to just N, which is J minus S. Then we can write this operator relationship. We really like the nuclear rotation, and it happens that the nuclear rotation of the neutral molecule and the ion, they have to be the same. For the ion, that's N plus minus the unit vector along the internuclear axis times lambda. Okay, so this is the orbital angular momentum of the ion core, lambda plus. So we can get R plus this way. So we have relationships between total angular momenta and ion core angular momenta and Rydberg electron angular momenta. And so when we specify basis states, we need to specify total angular momenta, ion core angular momenta, Rydberg electron angular momenta. And then we'll be able to evaluate the angular momenta matrix elements, all of the angular momenta matrix elements that we would encounter. And that's a fairly big subject, but, you know, we're trying to get to focus on the specific dynamical processes. And I'll introduce matrix elements, evaluation of matrix elements through specific examples. Okay, so now, because I want to illustrate things, I'm going to say we're going to have an ion core which is closed shell. In other words, it's in a singlet sigma plus state. There's no spin, there's no orbital angular momentum. And so all of the occupied orbitals are completely occupied. None of them are half occupied. And usually it also means that we've gone up and we've filled all the bonding orbitals and we haven't put any electrons in the antibonding orbitals. But, okay. And when that's true, R plus, which is something we want, is equal to N plus, which is equal to J plus. And S plus equals zero, lambda plus equals zero, sigma plus equals zero. So when we have a lot of zero angular momentum and equal angular momentum, you can imagine that the algebra is going to be simplified. Okay, we're going to talk about autoionization. In particular, mechanisms of autoionization. And there's several classes of autoionization that I intend to talk about. I'm going to talk about rotational autoionization at length. Then I'm going to talk about vibrational and spin orbit. And I doubt that I'm going to have time for all this. And so I didn't even bother writing any notes about the electronic case. Okay. The basis of rotational autoionization is that the ion core isn't round. And because it isn't round, the electron can exert a torque on it. Or it can exert a torque on the electron. If it were round, there wouldn't be any rotational autoionization. So, and the torques are periodic because if the ion core is rotating, the electron, if it's stationary, feels a torque which varies with the phase of the autoionization of the rotation, and the period or the frequency is the ion core rotational constant times 2 times the ion core rotational quantum. That's basically the energy separation between the N minus 1 and N rotational level. That's the period. The frequency. The rotational frequency is always given by an energy difference. And normally I like to say if we're interested in the average frequency at N, we take the average between N minus 1 and N plus 1 N. But we really want to know either the N minus 1 or N plus 1 N frequency, because those are the resonances that appear. And in one case, you're putting energy into the ion core, and the other, you're taking it out. Okay, so we have a torque, and it's modulating. And that sounds like a good thing for exchanging energy. So the effectiveness of the torque, or the ability to apply torque, has to do with how not round. And I'll show you that appears as the difference in quantum defects for the different values of lambda. And we'll play with that a lot. Okay. Vibrational. There's two ways of looking at the vibrational. One way is to look at the inner lobe of the Rydberg orbital. The inner lobe along a Rydberg series is constant. I told you that. You don't have to believe it, but it's true. Now, if we go to the lowest member of a Rydberg series, that is often a valence state. and one frequently classifies the orbitals in a valence state as, if we're talking about a relatively covalent molecule, the orbitals are either bonding or antibonding. If it's an ionic molecule, the orbitals are shielding or deshielding. So, if you occupy a bonding orbital, the vibration frequency gets increased. If you occupy a deshielding orbital, the vibrational frequency gets increased. If you shield, vibrational frequency goes down. If you put it in an antibonding orbital, vibrational frequency goes down. So you can sort of think of this as as the Rydberg electron goes from outside to inside, it's going to turn on an interaction which changes the vibrational frequency. Or you can think of that as an impulse. You have an oscillator and you hit it because it's happily oscillating, and all of a sudden it gets an impulse because its vibrational frequency has changed because the electron has come in. And that can cause a change in the vibration, quantum level. Another way of looking at this, so I just gave you the short range point of view. The long range point of view is that the ion core has a dipole moment and a quadrupole moment, and it's vibrating. And so these moments are modulated. And the Rydberg electron at long range feels that modulation. And so if that modulation frequency is close to the orbital frequency, the Kepler orbit frequency of the Rydberg electron, then you have a resonance. And even though the nuclei are heavy and the electron is light, at resonance, it's just the same sort of thing as you're driving a car. The road is really heavy. The car is pretty light. Energy does get transferred resonantly into these destructive vibrations of the car. And so there is a resonant coupling. And when energy gets transferred, it tends to be transferred in quanta. And so a vibrational quantum will suddenly appear in the electronic energy, or suddenly be removed because of this resonant coupling. So we have a short range and a long range interaction. And those are the physical mechanisms that will appear when we look at the quantum. Spin orbit. Spin orbit is kind of esoteric, but it's kind of neat because it's a different way of understanding. Now this, what I'm talking about here, is really the essence of this lecture. The rest is just going to be realization, building a model. But what you don't see is, what is the physical reason for this improbable energy transfer process occurring? Why is the resonance short-lived? Why doesn't it live forever? So we have states which have approximately good quantum numbers embedded in various continua. And why do they relax into the continuum? It's because of these mechanisms. Okay, so for spin orbit, you have an ion core. Let's say it's a doublet pi state, so we have a doublet pi 1/2 and a doublet pi 3/2. And there are Rydberg series built on both of these. So suppose we have an S Rydberg series that can contribute the spin of the electron, and so one can end up getting a singlet pi state and a triplet pi state. 0, 1, 2. So these are the projections of J on the internuclear axis, 0, 1, 2. So you have a singlet pi state, a triplet pi state, and there are spin orbit interactions that produce these splittings and produce an interaction between triplet pi 1 and singlet pi. So you stick an electron onto this, and the standard angular momentum coupling says you get a triple pi state and a single pi state. But now suppose the Rydberg electron is so far away that there is no reason for this difference in energy between single pi and triple pi. That's an exchange energy. That's it's basically, you know, how does an electron interact with one electron interact with another electron? It's an electrostatic interaction, but if the Rydberg electron never gets close to the other electron, the exchange splitting goes to zero. And so if the exchange splitting goes to zero, what you end up getting is a pattern not of two levels, but of four levels. And so you add so the total omega 2110, this splitting is the same as this. And so what happens in spin orbit autoionization is there is a spin orbit coupling between two states, the single pi and the triple pi state, and it's normally weak. But as the electrostatic splitting between those states gets small, the spin orbit can do what it wanted to do. It can destroy singlet and triplet. And so, again, it's a mechanism where the Rydberg electron isn't doing anything. It's just allowing what the core wanted to do to happen. So each one of these mechanisms requires a different way of thinking about how does this process occur. The last one, the electrostatic, the electronic, the Rydberg electron strikes the core and excites, it transfers some energy to a core electron, excites it to an excited electronic state. And that's an electron-electron collision. We know those can be good. Those can be very efficient in transferring energy between two particles of the same mass. So if there's enough energy for so what happens is you have states converging to an electronically, Rydberg series converging to an electronically excited state. And now that Rydberg electron enters the core and gets the core energy from the excited state, and it gets blown off because now the core is in the ground state and the electron has too much energy. So
it's a two-step process. You first have to excite the core, and then you have to...
Well, if you form the Rydberg state where the core is excited, then the electron comes in, de-excites the core, and carries that electron away. So those are the four mechanisms that are going to be appearing in autoionization rates. And now I'm going to do some of the quantum mechanics to show how you implement this. But the physical mechanisms are all things where you've got a good reason for exchanging energy between a light particle and a heavy particle. And your expectation of billiard balls and ping pong balls, there's no problem with that. But, you know, those are right. Your experience tells you it will never happen unless there's some kind of internal structure or some kind of periodic resonance. Okay, are we all content with it? This is really the important thing. This is sort of, in fact, it's the important, what I've been leading up to in the four lectures.
Molecules are not balls.
That's right. There is internal structure, and you reveal the internal structure, as much of it as you need, and you have a way of deciding what is reasonable and what is overly esoteric. So you you know, if you have ideas about quantum numbers, about mechanisms, and anything can happen. Nothing except, you know, energy J, MJ, and parity are rigorously conserved. But a lot of other things are going to be conserved unless there's a good reason why they won't. And you can always make decisions about what is the hierarchy of probability for a particular process. And as you go down that hierarchy to the improbable things, your best investment of effort is in ruling out the more probable things before you start to say, I think it's this really neat thing that I dreamt up some, you know, one night, and I'm going to devote my life to finding that effect. Okay, so let's try to describe the quantum mechanics of rotational autoionization. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the usual expected quantum mechanical approach to a problem. And it's going to be sort of backwards. It's going to say that the thing we expected to cause the process is the thing that's opposing the process, as opposed to causing it. And it's just a matter of which basis set we choose. And if we choose the other basis set, which is the one we are normally unaccustomed to using, then the causality gets straightened out. Okay, so I'm going to approach the problem from a normal coupling case, which is case B, which for this problem is essentially identical to case A, which is the one I recommended using all the time. And the good way of approaching the problem is case D, and you'll see that, you know, when I'm done. Okay. We'll be lucky just to get this done. So, the electronic Hamiltonian is the Rydberg constant over n minus delta. We can write delta L lambda squared. Okay, so this is just the usual Rydberg expression with a quantum defect, which is different for each L and lambda. And this is just saying, we only have diagonal elements in lambda. So the electronic Hamiltonian is diagonal, but the different lambdas have different energies. And this is due to the fact that the ion core isn't round. So, differences in diagonal energies are the things that oppose the coupling. This is the not roundness. This is the thing that enables the electron to exert a torque. And instead of causing a process, it's opposing it because it's appearing at H0. Okay. Now, so we have the electronic part of the problem and we have the rotational part of the problem. The rotational Hamiltonian is just the rotational constant, or rotational constant operator, times R plus squared. This is the ion core rotation. Well, R plus is N minus L for our particular example, because for the particular example, our ion core is closed shell. So all we do is remove orbital angular momentum from the total N, and we have N plus, but N plus is R plus. So R plus angular momentum squared is n squared plus l squared minus 2lz squared minus n plus l minus plus n minus l plus. These are not ion core quantum numbers. These are raising Laurier operators. So all I did is I just multiplied. So I have n squared, l squared, n di l, 2 n di l. And that, since nz is the same as lz, that's why we have that. And then this is what happens when we take the nx, lx, ny, ly, and we rearrange them into raising Laurier operators. Okay. So this gives diagonal elements, and this gives off-diagonal elements. Off-diagonal and lambda. So we can add to the diagonal elements the r times n plus 1 plus l plus 1 minus lambda squared 2 lambda squared. Okay. And then we have off-diagonal elements. Okay, matrix elements of n plus are nn plus 1 minus lambda plus or minus 1. Matrix elements of L minus, n plus is going to be this minus lambda minus 1. Matrix elements of L minus are LL plus 1 minus lambda times lambda minus 1. The thing that you always remember is an off-diagonal matrix element of a raising or lowering operator is going to have the product of the initial and final quantum numbers in here. So you don't really have to remember the pluses and minuses. You just know that it's going to be the initial times the final. Okay. So now let's simplify to the simplest possible case that actually could give rise to a rotational autoionization, and that's L equals 1. And when you have L equals 1, in other words, a P orbital, you can have a doublet pi Rydberg state or a doublet sigma Rydberg state. And so we need to be able to write the wave functions, the basis functions, and we have to write them in the parity basis because parity is an important quantum number. So we have the pi plus and minus 1, plus and minus states, 1 over square root 2 times lambda equals 1 plus or minus lambda equals minus 1. And the sigma is exclusively plus, and it's just lambda equals 0. So we want to calculate matrix elements of these two states. Or for those who've had only 561, we want to calculate integrals. And integrals of the operators that we've got here. And we know what each of these operators does to one of those functions, and so the integral is just going to be apply the operator to the function, and then take the other function and find the terms of what the operator produced that have the same angular momentum function already there. So when you integrate, you either get 0 or 1. Alright, so it's, you can do it. Alright, so when we put it all together, what we're going to get is a matrix for the rotational Hamiltonian labeled in this way. So we have P X plus 2. X is equal to N and N plus 1. Okay? Just to make the writing less onerous. B X square root times 2. 0. Symmetric. So that's the same as that. B X plus 2 minus 2. 0. 0. 0. B. X. That's, so that's what we get from the rotational Hamiltonian. When we evaluate matrix elements of B R squared, we get this matrix. And it's a 2 by 2 and a 1 by 1. The pi minus is by itself. The pi plus interacts with the sigma. And so this is the only off-diagonal element in the problem. We have a difference in diagonal elements associated with this. We have a small difference in diagonal elements associated with that. And this is the bad guy. This expresses a Coriolis effect. As the ion rotates, and if the electron is in that rotating coordinate system and trying to move, there's a Coriolis force on it. And so that Coriolis force gets to be large enough that it overcomes the difference in energy associated with having the electron on the internuclear axis or perpendicular to it. But that's sort of backwards. It's a perfectly complete model. It gives all of the relevant coupling terms. But the mechanism that I told you ought to be the way we look at it is that somehow there is this not round object and it can exert a torque on the electron or the electron can exert a torque on it. And all of the basis for that torque appears in the difference between the pi and the sigma quantum defects, which are on the diagonal.
This is a little simplistic, but I'm still not, it's hard for me to see how the rotation of this molecule can somehow come in resonance with this Kepler motion of the electron. I mean, to exert the torque, you would think that somehow the rotations would have to be.
Becomes especially damaging. here's how it works.
The radius is so huge that, you have.
So even though electron is whizzing about, it's so much more.
Yeah, no matter how fast it's moving, along the orbit.
The Kepler frequency is the Rydberg times two over n cubed. Okay, it's basically the difference between successive Rydberg series. So we have Rydberg series with quantum number one over n squared with energy one over n squared. The difference is the derivative of that, and so that's when we get this. Okay, so that's the Kepler. And so as n gets large, the Kepler frequency gets smaller. The rotational frequency is b 2bn. Okay, so we pick a particular n, And that determines then the lowercase n at which the resonance occurs. Okay, so you can, for any motion, one can always go to high enough principal quantum number to get resonance between the Kepler motion and that other thing. Okay, it turns out that for molecules with the usual size rotation constant, that corresponds to principal quantum numbers on the order of 100 or 200, which are ridiculously high and difficult to do. But for H2, it corresponds to quite low principal quantum numbers. Okay. Okay, in order to write a nice Hamiltonian, I have to do some algebra. So we're on page 6. And we're going to, whenever we have a 2x2 problem, we always want to symmetrize it. We want to take out an average energy, so that the Hamiltonian has the form of plus delta over 2 minus delta over 2 on the diagonal and an off diagonal. And so that's what this is all about. And so I define two quantities. I define the quantum defect average for the p orbital as delta p sigma plus delta p phi over 2. And I define the difference for the p orbital as delta p sigma minus delta p pi over 2. And then you can express 1 over n minus delta sigma squared as n minus delta p minus 2 plus n minus delta p r minus 3 times 2 delta p. And similarly, 1 over n minus delta pi squared. As the same thing here, the same thing here, but this minus 2 delta p. Okay, that's just algebra. And so we've taken out an average term, and we've produced the difference term, which is just the same thing with opposite sides. And so when we've done that, our full Hamiltonian has the form H over HC is equal to H bar, that's just diagonal, plus this big thing. We have B plus minus the Rydberg Q delta P over n minus delta p r cubed. We have b x square root 0. We have b x square root, and then we have b minus minus b, and then plus. Okay. Same thing. Okay, so this is the same as this, but it just has the opposite sign. Except that now I've got, yeah, that's right. building. And then over, so then we have 0 and 0 and 0, and finally over here we have minus b plus this thing here. Okay? So these two have the same diagonal elements. These two have diagonal elements which are plus and minus. There's one off diagonal element here. And so we can solve this 3x3 problem now by inspection. And what you end up finding is for a given value of n, the pi plus and the sigma, Rydberg series, converge to n is equal, n plus is equal to n plus or minus 1. And the pi minus converges to n plus equals n. Okay. Yeah, I've still got a little ways to go to even finish this first half of the problem. So we have a Hamiltonian matrix that describes the interaction between pi and sigma. Now, suppose we're in n equals 1. And we're at an energy above n plus equals 0. Okay, so this is the first ionization limit. So there's going to be n plus 1, n plus equals 2. Okay, so suppose we're looking at the three states with n equals 1. So there's a Rydberg series converging to this n equals 2 limit. Could interact with the continuum associated with the n equals 0 limit. These two states have the same parity. They have the same total angular momentum. We know the coupling matrix element between them. So there is an energy region that is nn plus 1, so that's 2 times 3 is 6. So it's 6 b wide. And what is the n? What is the lowest n that could be above this limit? And so we say 6b is equal to the Rydberg over n squared. Okay, and we solve for n. And so n minimum is the square root of the Rydberg over 6b. Okay, the Rydberg is 100,000. The b value is typically 1. And so 100,000 over 6 is about 17,000. Square root of that is about what? 40. That would be, it's 40 times roughly 3. It's a little over 100. So for ordinary molecules, this process starts to occur for Rydberg states going to n equals 2 with principal Kolmogorov numbers 100 or higher. They're very close together. For hydrogen, it starts much, much lower because the rotational constant is what, something like 60 wave numbers. So, all right, so we have a matrix. The matrix says that the series with n plus of 2 can interact with the series of n plus equals 0, and there's this matrix element. We have the energy differences. So it's a solved problem, but it's expressed in this peculiar way where the thing that causes the dynamics is here, and So this is a picture where the dynamics is essentially caused by Coriolis effects against the non-sphericity of the core. And that is a way of looking at it, but I don't like that one as much. So this way is a case B or a case A picture. And let me just go. Remember, I did a little problem on page 15 of lecture number 1, which I did as the first page of lecture number 2. And if you have two terms in the Hamiltonian, one producing a difference in energy and one producing an off-diagonal element, you can always go to an opposite representation where the roles are reversed. So in case D, picture is precisely that. In a case D, the wave function is specified by a quantum number n, n plus, l, l sub r, n plus and minus. So l sub r is the projection of l on n plus, instead of the projection of l on the internuclear axis. And n minus n plus in the case D limit. So this is not an operator equation, this is a quantum number equation. The rotational Hamiltonian in case D, B of R times n plus squared. Well, isn't that nice? This doesn't have, you see, n plus is here. So, in case D, this only has diagonal elements. Now, there's going to be several different diagonal elements depending on the values of L sub R. So, let's make a little table. We have n, n plus, L sub R, n plus squared. Well, since n is a good quantum number, what we're interested in is three states of the same value of n. And n plus can be n plus 1 and n minus 1. Well, since n minus n plus is L sub R, we have minus 1, 0, and 1. And so the matrix element of n plus squared is going to be n, n plus 1, and n plus 1, and n plus 1, plus 2, plus 2n, minus 2n. So that's it. That's how we figure out what goes on the diagonal. So we have a term that we want to take out because it's common, and then we have some differences. So as far as the rotational Hamiltonian is concerned, it's completely diagonal, but there is a little bit of a difference on diagonal between these two states. Now we also, I should have put in parity, plus minus, and the parity is minus 1 to the n for a P complex, minus 1 to the n, minus 1 to the n. Okay, so these are the two things that can interact. All right. And recall, we had this over here. This was the difference along the diagonal. When we go to case D, what had been a difference on the diagonal gets moved to the off diagonal. And so what we're going to end up getting for H1 in case D is going to be something that looks about like this. 0, 2 times the Rydberg delta, delta P, 0, and minus delta P R to the third power, 0, 0, so we have this anisotropy term here as the off-diagonal term, and we have the rotation as producing a little tiny bit. Oops. The rotation is producing a little tiny bit of energy denominator, difference in energy diagonal. So this is much nicer, because now what we have is this quantum defect difference acting as the coupling term, and it's fighting against a very, very small energy difference associated with the rotation. So this is the formulation of the problem that expresses the causal role of the non-sphericity through the difference in quantum defect. And it's overcoming a small rotational effect associated with the different values of the orthologous projections. That's it. I think I should stop, because this was a fairly heavy-duty derivation. We're out of time, and the vibrational auto-ionization would also be fairly heavy-duty, so I think that's enough. I hope that this was useful and gave you the flavor of how we characterize dynamics in even the simple systems of diatomics, and that it will give you ideas for how you would carry some of these things over to more complicated systems, not necessarily even gas phase molecules. That you want to form a representation, a zero-order picture, and then say, okay, what are the possible things that could spoil that, and then work out what would be the consequences. And often, there are two complementary representations, and one often gives you the insight, and one is often the one that you're most likely to fall on first, which doesn't give you the insight. And that's it. So wait till next IAP when I have to do some more of these things. I hope that helped. I wish we had more time, but I could do this more carefully. But the spirit is there. Okay. Yes?
So if in the Rydberg state, the electron is... if it can pick up energy from a rotation of the ion core,
yes,
and that's enough to ionize it, that means it's really, I mean, the energy difference between the ionization and the energy of the electron is really small.
Well, that's what I was doing over here.
Right, okay, so it's on the order of, you know, the rotational energy of the ion core. So...
Well, it's even less than that, because you're going to only be able to change the rotational energy of the ion core by a few quanta,
so
like two.
My question is this: if you've got this really high energy,
mm-hmm.
and you've got some uncertainty in that energy, isn't that uncertainty much bigger than the separation?
Why would you have any uncertainty?
I just assumed you would. Well, I mean, how long is the lifetime of the Rydberg state? If it's any kind of finite lifetime, you've got uncertainty in the energy of the...
Well, that's right. Well, the uncertainty in the energy is what gives the width. I mean, the lifetime,
right.
You have a process, you have a continuum, and I didn't talk about it. You have a bound state and a continuum, and there's a coupling matrix element between them, and Fermi's golden rule tells you the rate,
mm-hmm.
Right.
And whatever the rate is the lifetime.
So from a naive point of view, before I listen to this, I would say, all right, I've got an electron with a high energy, and there's just an uncertainty. The uncertainty in that energy overlaps with the ionization, and I would say, okay, there's some probability it's going to ionize. But what this is saying is, like, this is the mechanism of how that actually happens.
Exactly. And so in the zero-order states, there is no uncertainty in the energy. You have, you know, energies that have trivially calculable values. And so your zero-order bound state, your resonance state, has a definite energy, and it's coupling to a continuum, which doesn't have a definite energy, but all that matters is what is the density of the continuum at the energy of your bound state. And now you get a coupling rate, which is a matrix element squared times the density of states in the continuum, and that gives you the life, the width. The rate is the width.
Right. Okay.
So most people approach the dynamics in a way similar to what you just described, but that's kind of a self-fulfilling closed end, you know, that you don't have a mechanism at all. And as long as there are not many competing mechanisms that could produce the ionization, then it's usually possible to get the smoking gun, to say this is the mechanism that gives rise to this this particular observation of dynamics. And it's very rare in diatomics that you have to worry about multiple competing mechanisms. It does happen. Has happened.
Can I ask another question?
Absolutely.
When you rank the mechanisms that lead to auto-ionization, what was the basis of the ranking again? I think you told us what it did. Because you said the rotational was the most effective.
Well, I didn't really mean to say that.
Maybe I misunderstood.
The rotational is kind of one of the easiest to understand, because you've got this thing that, and you can, so that's a very classical picture. It really depends on where you are relative to the lowest ionization limit. If you're far above it, and nothing much has happened until suddenly something happens, then you know that it's either a spin orbit or an electronic process. You know the spin orbit couplings and the, you know all the constants of the ion. So if you're looking at your spectrum above the lowest threshold and you see things happening near a vibrational level of the ion or near a spin orbit interval of the ion or near an electronic excitation of the ion, you know the dominant process will be spin orbit, electronic, rotation, vibration. And so, just by looking at where it is relative to the threshold, it tells you which mechanism to look for first. It's possible to be very definite about the strength of a rotational and a vibrational and a spin orbit auto-ionization process, because all of the relevant stuff that determines the coupling constant is available to you through other kinds of observations. For electronic auto-ionization, that is really, that's a number. The coupling strength is not a number that you can estimate. You have to calculate it or observe it. But all of the others, you can get them by a kind of a backdoor route.
So the effectiveness of the mechanism is determined by how close you are to being already ionized. That's how you decide which mechanism is the most relevant or most likely to be the most relevant.
I said two different things. I think you're conflating them into one.
Okay.
First, you look at the energy at which the process you're interested in turns on. and that will point towards one of the processes. Then, the strength of the coupling that drives each of the processes for three of the cases can be deduced from other stuff. For the fourth case, the electronic one, I don't know how you estimate that a priori.
You probably have to do a full ad initio.
Absolutely. It would be very easy because it's basically, you probably can get it out of, not even a full ab initio, you probably get it out of Hartree Fock because it's really a one electron process. But whatever, yes, you can get it ab initio. But it generally does not yield itself to semi empirical guesses, whereas the other ones really do. And in my notes, you'll see, I mean, for the rotational, it was the difference in quantum defects, which you observe Rydberg series. You know what the difference in the quantum defects is, so you know what the coupling is. For vibration, it comes from the derivative of the quantum defect with R, which you can get either from observation of vibrational perturbations at known places in the Rydberg series, or by the difference in the shape of the ion curve, potential curve, from the valence terminus curve, because those vertical differences are what you get the quantum defect from as a function of R. And so by looking at the R dependence of that vertical difference, and that's sort of telling you, is the Rydberg orbital bonding or antibonding, shielding or deshielding, that's determining how the potential curves are shifted. And so, and spin orbit is just the spin orbit splitting in the ion. So all of three of those things are easily obtainable without looking at dynamical processing, looking at autoionization. But the other one is, as far as I know, I can't think of a way of estimating it. I'm sure I could.